Clint Barton, aka Hawkeye, became the greatest sharpshooter known to man. He then joined the Avengers. This is what he does when he's not being an Avenger. I'm Eddie Webb, and today we're going to talk about Hawkeye 7, 6, 17, 8, and 9 today on Speechless. Hey guys, and welcome to the second episode of this little kind of sub-podcast Speechless, where I talk about the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run from 2012 to 2014. And off the bat, I want to kind of apologize for the somewhat frenetic pace of last episode. Now, this is definitely a show series I feel very strongly about, but also I'm still getting used to talking to myself. I'm still getting used to the pace of how we do these things kind of on my own. The last time I did a podcast where I was just talking by myself was well over a decade ago. I've gotten very used to having co-hosts who can kind of moderate my pace. So if you thought enough of the first episode to come listen to this one, I really do appreciate it. But I will say in my defense that the first few issues of it are a lot of setup. I mean, really what we covered kind of last episode, the arc was really establishing Clint and Kate's relationship, and also setting up the kind of core dilemma, which is that Clint is in this apartment building, which is being purchased by Mafioso, the Russian so-called Trusted Mafia, and the continued bad decisions made that caused the situation to slowly spiral out of control. We're now going to be hitting kind of the ramping up, kind of almost the lead up to Act Two, if you will, of this arc. So this is going to be kind of an interesting run, and I definitely think a little slower pace. But also, I think it's going to be important because we are taking these a little out of order. And there's a reason for that. So basically, there's a concept called a fill-in issue, okay? And something that happens in comic books, particular comic books that has strict monthly schedule. You don't see it as much lately for a lot of reasons. But particularly in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, if a writer or artist was late in delivering their material, they would have an issue that was created either by a separate team or created previously and was kept on file, where they would just be able to slot that in. They would maybe do a page on either end to kind of talk about the current situation and why we're going off course for an issue. And then that gives the artist an extra month to kind of get caught up on the main title, as it were. These days, generally comics just end up shipping late, and that's just kind of how it is. But in particular, this run, David Aja was doing such great work. He needed extra time to work, particularly on issues 7 and 8. So, and you'll see, as we go through, I'll also show you other areas where I kind of like there were little shortcuts to give David Aja some extra breathing room, because his art style, as I mentioned before, is so ornate. But this was issue 16 and 18, which needed the extra time. So 17 was done as a fill-in issue, but it was actually a callback to issue 6. So 17 comes after issue 6, but also 7 makes a little more sense if you kind of look at it right before. You kind of need to look 6, 7 and isolate at the same time. So narratively, we're going backwards, forwards in time, but considering the way these issues have been structured, that's not necessarily bad. So it does make sense to kind of read 7 before 6. But if you want to read 6 before 7, that's fine too. It's just 17 is nice to have kind of with 6 because it's a follow-on from 6. But we'll get to there. But that's why we have the weird order. So we are going to jump ahead to 7. If you've got Comixology or trade paperbacks, kind of flip to that. Again, I have the Omnibus, which I checked on eBay right before recording. It's like $200, which is a shame. I'm really, you'd expect with the Disney show that they would have reprinted this, and it's a shame because it's a fantastic, beautiful volume. But anyway, Issue 7. This is, the top of it tells us is October 29th in Brooklyn. And we're already seeing evolutions of the kind of opening phrase, because for a while I talked about how it was Hawkeye saying, this looks bad. This looks really bad. This looks really, really bad. And now it's, okay, this storm is really starting to look bad. So we're already seeing kind of a play on that opening hook, which is great. It's a nice way to kind of lend some structure to which could be a relatively chaotic storyline. But it's basically, it's a nasty flood. We're looking at two characters, Clint and a man he calls Grills. Grills, we saw him briefly a couple issues ago, where he was a man who was grilling some meat as part of that kind of big rooftop picnic barbecue that was happening a few issues ago. He wasn't given a name there. Here he's called Grills. Issue 6 actually goes into the backstory of this, and also why Grills calls him Hawk Guy and not Hawkeye. Again, we'll talk about that in issue 6. There's a storm coming, so it's helping, moving stuff around, moving boxes around to get it from the potential flooding. And again, there's a great moment where, Grill says, hey, I figured you'd be out doing Avengers stuff. And Clint says, hard to shoot an arrow with a storm out there, buddy. And then he says in kind of smaller case, oh, tape, you're useless. And it's, again, another running gag of Clint's, and I think Kate as well, talking to objects. And coffee, when the coffee pot gets spilled. And this is, oh, tape. So it's kind of a running gag of talking to things, which is cute and it's fun. But also, it does strangely pay off later. Clint and Grills are in the process of getting stuff into Grills' car, where they're going to Rockaway, and they talk about the difference between Rockaway Beach and Far Rockaway, and also the Ramones song Rockaway Beach, which as a old punk fan, I love that kind of little call out. And this struggles with the trunk of the car. And they actually talk about the Ramones. Grills is packing up his stuff to take to his father in Far Rockaway because he's worried about his dad, especially with the storm. And so they get stuff out of the basement because the basement is flooding at his dad's house. Clint makes a comment of we're almost out of sand and bags, so that's pretty much it for the sandbags. There's always been a strong bantery tone to the Hawkeye series, but this one kind of really showcases that it's really Clint and Kate's relationship. And when they extrapolate that to other people, it doesn't always work. So, if you counterpoint some other writers, banter is everything. Kind of this era of Marvel, there's a lot of Bendis infused, everyone kind of has a bantery thing, but sometimes that can overwhelm the voice of the characters. Some of Joss Whedon's work, for example, everyone's kind of snarky and sassy, and that can be fun, but if not done well, it means that characters lose definition. In this case, everyone's a little sarcastic, but Clint is the one doing it actively, and Kate goes alongside that. One of the reasons they get along well is they have a very similar sense of humor and also a way of using humor to mask their lack of communication, their pain. But as you see Clint bouncing off of Grills and Grills' dad, you see that style doesn't always play well. And you see that there's a Grills' dad just doesn't seem to care about what's going on. It's like, just here's all mom stuff, that their mother has passed away. Grills' mother's passed away. And he's like, I don't care, just let it all float away. It's just stuff. Let it all wash away. And they're having this fight while Clint's handling it. And they see that actually the storm is even worse. There's actually a flood coming. It actually breaks down the door. They have to go upstairs. The car gets washed away. The nice cherry car they picked up in issue 3 actually gets washed away. And you see everything. And he sees that Quirrells is gone, talks to his dad, and Clint realizes he doesn't know Quirrells' real name. He only ever called him Quirrells. And so it's like, Clint immediately has like, your son. He's trying to cover it up, but you see the internal monologue of like, you idiot, how do you not know this man's name? And it's like, and of course, it's like, why would you call him Quirrells? It doesn't matter right now. And so it turns out the girls went down to get more of his mother's stuff. He's trapped in the water. Clint gets him out, and the house is basically ruined. And Quirrells and his father kind of reconcile. The father mentions that there's a boat up in the attic, so they actually find little rowboats. And so they get into the rowboats and they talk about the Quirrells. And turns out his name is actually Gilbert. So it's a young Quirrell, okay, Gills, Kim Quirrells. And from there we flash back to a scene with Clint and Kate. And what's interesting is we talk about this is the payback to the tape thing. Oh, tape. And it's because Clint doesn't actually have good tape. He has just kind of crappy cellophane tape. And Clint bitches about that. So we see the payoff, we see the joke after the payoff for the joke, which again is great. One thing that I love about Fractions thing is that because he uses times place things to kind of set up jokes that would not be funny in sequence, but because of the way it's out of sequence, it ends up being a little funnier to my mind. But the way you don't see Kate's there, she's obviously talking, but her words are coming from the frame. We see her hands. Again, I've talked last episode about how this is all kind of framed from Clint's perspective. This is another example of, it's only the bottom of the page where you get a full on view of Kate. And she's all dressed up. She's got a nice dress on, nice hat. Again, all purple coordinated because she was invited to an engagement party. And so she's in a dress to go to New Jersey. And then this, when the storms happened. And so Clint kind of talks like, why is it doing now? And it's like, it's New Jersey and the traditional Brooklyn, New Jersey kind of rivalry. And so she kicks him out of the apartments, which is his apartment, and she just, Kate does not care. She's furious. And so we see Kate's at the hotel in New Jersey where the storm happened. So now we're seeing the storm from Kate's perspective. Power transformers explode, so the hotel is out of power. And so she is helping people who are, this woman who needs her medication, can't get her medication. And so Kate rips her dress, takes off her high-heeled shoes, puts on some combat boots, and actually dives through the flooded car park deck to get out into the street so she can make her way to the pharmacy to get the medication. And because she's expecting trouble, she has taken her bow and arrows, of course. And so she goes to the pharmacist and it is being looted. So she has two guys cornered. She's getting ready to shoot the arrow. A third person knocks her unconscious with a can of beans, of all things. But she steps outside and she sees that the three looters have actually been cornered by some other locals. Some of the locals are actually the people who own the pharmacy and they give her the medications for her friend. The whole thing is a payoff of two things. One is the whole real people are the real heroes thing, which is something that you'll see a trend in through the series, that both Hawkeyes are kind of the middle ground between the average person on the streets and the traditional superheroes we see in all of these comics. And their exposure to the everyday heroism of these people, something that this series really showcases well. So we have Gil's quiet heroism of trying to make sure his dad's okay, both emotionally and physically during a storm. And then these people who are stopping these looters in order to make sure the woman gets her medication back at the hotel. And it kind of ends with Kate going to talk about how New Jersey rules and validating her support of New Jersey, whereas Clint's kind of also comes through his support of New Yorker tenacity. And it ends with them going, the storm's kind of abated. They both end back at the apartment. And she's like, I need to crash somewhere. And so stays on the couch and they kind of bicker about that. And then again, one of the other kind of running gags is, you know, thank you, Hawkeye, after you, Hawkeye. They killing each other, Hawkeye. But that's kind of issue 7, which is kind of a nice little character piece showing how both Hawkeyes relate to people, and also sets up this idea that after the first 6 issues, from our perspective, first 5 issues, but for 6 issues, of them working together, what it's like to have these characters and they work in isolation, and the fact that they have their own different ways of doing things, but they still have some core heroic tenets. So then we go back to issue 6, which takes place earlier, and this is 6 Days in the Life of, and I forgot to read credits. The credits for issue 7 were written by Matt Fraction, drawn by Steve Lieber and Jesse Hamm, again, kind of helping out David Aja. Color artist was Matt Hollingsworth, and letterer is Chris Lipiolis. 6 Days in the Life of is written by Matt Fraction, artist by David Aja. Color art by Matt Hollingsworth and letterer by Chris Lipiolis. So again, we have in this issue the kind of tendency we've seen in previous issues of Aja to do lots of really small panels and use that to tell a story. Because it's basically it is Clint trying to set up a VCR system, and Tony Stark is helping, and by helping, he's really kind of watching. And it's framed like it's a bomb sequence, but it turns out to be just a VCR, and it's supposed to be setting up for Christmas. Clint's like, yeah, you know, I can untangle it, and you know, you're supposed to be a genius. He's like, I can't set this stuff up. I can just buy a whole new system for you, because you know, Tony Stark, he's like, this is slightly outdated even for him. But again, what's a nice thing about this is that along the page section of page 2, we actually see a DVR, VCR, DVD, AV, TV setup, and how all the wires would connect together and how it ties into a satellite dish. And it's a nice little complicated array, but again, it looks like it's out of an instruction manual. David Aja has this extremely clean clinical style, and the way he juxtaposes extremely trivial, descriptive imagery to contrast the emotional height of the scene is always interesting. So you have this mess of wires and this chaos of this apartment floor as we're looking top down on both Clint and Tony Stark. And then alongside, there's this very clear instructional diagram. It really provides a contrast. Then we jump back to December 13th with Wolverine, Spider-Man, and Clint fighting some AIM agents. And at this point in time, Wolverine and Spider-Man, I believe, are in the Avengers, or they're new Avengers. But it's kind of a pretty traditional, you know, fight scene, except for it's all shot, if you will, from kind of the same angle. You're seeing bits and pieces of the same scene, but the camera initially is not moving in or zooming in the characters. So it looks like it's the AIM agents are coming in from the right. And then there's the fights, and then eventually when the fight's over, Clint gets knocked out. When he wakes back up, all of the AIM agents are being led off again to the right when the SHIELD agents arrive. They talk about Dog Cops, which is a fictional TV show that both Spider-Man and Wolverine are fans of, but Clint has not seen, and so he doesn't want spoilers. And so he's like, I'm going to go home. He's got the whole season on DVR. He wants to go watch it, which pace forward to the scene we just saw of him trying to set up said VCR. And it's going to be his holiday. He's going to just sit down, cook up his DVR, and watch Dog Cops for and through the holiday season. And Spider-Man makes a Happy Hanukkah reference because playing with the strong implied Jewish related characters of the Marvel Universe that only occasionally explicitly become Jewish, but certainly it's always in the backgrounds there. There are certain characters in the Marvel Universe who are explicitly coded as Jewish, but the whole universe is always, because two of the main creators were Jewish, it's always been kind of there in the background, and modern Marvel likes to kind of bring that forward every now and then. It's one of those nice little touches of, like, you know, the fact that this is a multi-denominational community. So we go back to the 18th, where there's more of talking about AV hookups with Tony and Clint. Tony almost spoils the end of Dog Cops. Clint gets very mad at him. And he talks about, he's like, you know, you got to make it work. Kind of the running theme of Clint wanting to poke this stuff up himself is that you got to make your own stuff work out. It's something he'll repeat throughout this issue. The next page cuts to the day before, the 17th, where he starts unboxing all the things because he realizes he never actually fully unpacked after moving into this apartment. Everything's been going bonkers ever since he first got there. So now he's unpacking. He pulls out his laser discs. There's a picture of the Blade Runner laser disc. He makes a reference of all these moments will be lost, like tears in the rain, Lucky. He talks to the dog. And as he's unpacking, his neighbor, Simone, brings her kids over, and they mention a problem with their apartment is that the cable's been out. And something's wrong with the satellite dish. And the super is talking about how I'm not climbing the fire escape in the snow to fix the dish. And we cut to a picture of said dish, and there's an arrow sticking out of it. And so Clint's like, oh yeah, that's on me. So he feels bad because the kid's favorite Christmas show is coming on next week. They don't have a way to watch it. We cut to the 14th, 3 days ago, and Clint is receiving a DVR, which actually has all of Dog Cops on it. So we find out that the DVR is actually not even his DVR. He's getting it from Grills. Grills wishes him a joyous Kwanzaa and calls him Hawkeye. And now we see the gag paying off. It's like, Hawkeye. And the guy's like, oh, you mean Hawkeye? It's like, you know, Hawkeye. He's like, Hawk, yes, I, yes, Hawkeye, Hawkeye. And just like the guy on MASH, he's like, yeah, he's like, yeah, guy. And it's fun for a couple of reasons. One is obviously it's a humorous play on words, and again, is paying back to what we read in 7 about not understanding the people around you and how these kinds of misunderstandings can eventually snowball. But also, it's a hearing joke. With a character who has hearing loss. And so I actually found that funny. I know some people could take that as offensive. It's like, you know, you're making fun of someone's hearing. It's like, but it's not the person with hearing loss who's mishearing this. It's the other person who is not quite getting the nuance of Hawkeye and Hawkeye. And it plays to a relatively human relationship, particularly people with hearing loss, of the not quite hearing something right and saying it wrong and not realizing you're saying it wrong. So it humanizes Grills in a very way, and also deflates Clint because, again, the running gag has been going through this is Hawkeye is not respected in the same way as the other Avengers, and this is another small example of that. One of his friends, or at least people he lives with, acquaintances, can't even get his name right. So it's fun for a few different reasons, but I liked it because it's a hearing gag, but told in text. So they have to kind of sell it a little better. But once you kind of hear it in your head, it's like, oh, I see how that mistake can happen. It's an audio gag done in a visual medium. So when you kind of make humor transfers that and do it in a stronger way, I think it's really, really fun. And they're talking about Hawkeye again a little bit again. But then the track suit mafia show up. Clint threatens them. And they two more vans pull up with even more tracksuit guys coming out. And so he's like, oh, this is not good. And Clint gets the crap beaten out of him. And so there's a nice little bit of a bag goes on his head. And we see on the left side of the page, Friday, December 14th, then a clock striking midnight. And then at the right side of the page, Saturday, December 15th. So it's a nice little way of showing how time has transitioned. Again, these small little very precise panels, like Friday and Saturday don't quite fit in a panel, so they're doubled up on top of each other. But it's they're stacked in a very clean and precise way. And they take his bag off. And while Clint was getting beat up, he was, you know, threatening, you better get some more guys, you better get some more guys. And then they take the bag off, and there's like, you just see tons of silhouettes surrounding him. And he goes, oh, good, you got more guys. Again, that kind of acerbic humor. And again, visually great, because all of the and the rank and file of Trekkers and Mafia are in black silhouettes. But then their boss appears, and he's wearing a white suit. And so to contrast that, his suit and his glasses are in white, although the rest of him is in black. So he immediately stands out from the crowd while still, from a color perspective, being seen as connected to it. I've repeatedly talked about how the coloring is great on this. Is another fantastic example of color as emotional rather than literal. And there's some fantastic examples that Matt Hollingsworth has done throughout this run. So the boss talks about the things that Clint has done. Turns out that the woman that Cherry that he helped escape turns out is the boss's wife. So she's escaped town. And now he's trying to steal the building. Basically says he's working from some very scary people, and they want this building very bad. So you have 24 hours to resolve all of this, or there's going to be a war. And then Clint is dragged by the building and kicked out into the street. We cut ahead. That's Wednesday. Clint hangs everything up. He believes he set everything up so he can watch Dog Cops. And specifically behind him, his arrow is hung up over the couch. And it's not and he calls it home. And it's very, very clear, Clint has made a decision. He's not going to sit idly by. Even though from a time standpoint, this is well past 48 hours, right? So something has happened kind of in the meantime, or 24 hours, sorry. So something's happened obviously in the meantime. And we cut back to that. He talks about also owning his life. Something he calls a car crash for life. But he gifts his bow to Kate right after he gets back from his beating. So we jump to later on the 15th, that same day, where she shows up with the bow in hand. It's like, what the hell is this? And he's packing. He's like, where are you going? It's like, nowhere. And he's like, where are you going? Why are you yelling at me? And Clint's basically saying, the bad guys are coming after me, so I'm going to leave and lure them away. And Kate's like, you are the good guy. This is what good guys do, is they stay and fight. And she says, she hands him back the bow and is like, this thing you're about to do, this running away thing, it's everything about you that sucks. And that's another big key point, is we're now seeing the conflict between Kate and Clint, and Kate has finally articulated it, is that Clint is ultimately a coward. He is a hero. He sees himself as a coward, and everybody else sees him as a hero. So Clint still thinks of himself as a criminal and a coward, and so he always downplays the heroic things he does, whereas other people, through the voice of Kate, see him as the hero, and so when he stumbles, they call him on it. So again, we have another shot of that kind of left-to-right thing of Saturday to Sunday. So 24 hours have passed. There's a guy in our tracksuit mafia in the van who kind of does the finger gun at him as Clint steps out. And we have a huge splash page of Clint standing by himself in front of the building in the snow with the bow and arrow. He's ready. We again cut to Wednesday after this. And Clint and the guy has invited the kids into his apartment so they can watch their Christmas show in his house, because he has things set up. And basically, if you can figure out how this works, you can watch Christmas shows as long as you want to until your mom tells you to stop. And you need to be anywhere. And he's like, no, I'm right where I need to be. And that's the end of the issue. We don't actually, something has happened. We don't actually see it yet. That's what we're going to see. And again, issue 7 doesn't even go into that. Issue 7 also kind of skips that. So that's why reading works a little better, because the way time is being played in issue 6, the fact you read issue 7 ahead of time, it actually plays into that time jump a bit more. And because it's focused on Grills, it's okay if we see the kind of the Grills guy gag later, because there are other gags inside issue 6 that pay off in reverse order. So I think it actually plays a little better to read those backwards. So I agree with the relationship. Then we get to issue 17, which is written by Matt Fraction, artist by David Aja and Chris Eliopoulos, color art by Jordi Belair, and lettered by Chris Eliopoulos. And basically, this is the kids sitting in to watch the show, which are called the Winter Friends. You see one page by David Aja. So it's right after the end of issue 6, so why this slots in perfectly in that point. And then it's kind of Clint's spacing out. He's clearly thinking about something. And then he's watching the mom and Lucky are both passed out. And so it's just him and the kids watching this thing, and they zoom in on his eye. And we cut to a completely different art style, which I believe is the Chris Eliopoulos art, which very cartoony, almost kind of Peanuts, kind of an homage to the Peanuts Christmas special. And even the song is scans to the Charlie Brown Christmas theme song. It's meant to be Winter Friends are the multi-denominational animal superhero friends. So there's Yalda, the proud pooch of power, representing the Persian holiday Yalda. There's Rama in pajamas, the Hindu deity Down, and Diwali, and also a llama. There's Santalope, ho ho ho, make way for the Yuletide Titan. There's Samantha Hain, the pagan princess. There's Kwanzaa Gator, the champion chomper of all the fruits of the harvest, and Minorable, which is nine lives, nine candles, the climb. And so it's the story is kind of secondary, but it's about how the sun in the suit have actually melted away all of the snow, so the kids can't have fun in winter because things are too out there, and they get all taken out, and so they could have to rely on their friend Steve, who's a dog with no powers. And Steve is a one-eyed dog who can hear someone's at his name. And so he's going to go and rescue his winter friends. And a tiny little friend dog named Lil comes, and she wants to help. And so she's like, I want to help. And Steve's like, no, you have to stay here. You're too small. I can do it by myself. So obviously a metaphor for Clint and Kate's relationship, Steve being the dog with no powers relates to his relationship with the Avengers. The Winter Friends are all kind of analogs of the Avengers. And Lil is an analog to Kate, who wants to help. And Steve's catchphrase, if I could do it all by myself, really plays into Clint's, you got to fix your own stuff. You got to take care of your own stuff. So the whole thing is an analog for Steve's relationship with Clint's relationship with Kate. There's a big dog named Brother, who is Steve's brother, their adventure brothers. And that's actually a reference to some issues we will see later. So actually, Clint's brother does become relevant. So this is one of the few times where this issue began out of order, quote unquote, is confusing. But not really. I mean, if the whole thing plays with time, so getting a reference to a character relationship we haven't seen yet, it's still established for Clint, and this is all in Clint's mind. Spoiler, I guess. This is all Clint's dream. So it's still relevant to him, so it still makes sense, even if we as the reader aren't quite getting all the nuance just yet. There are tracksuit dingoes who attack. They all fight. They manage to actually fend off the tracksuit dingoes. Steve's like, I could do it all by myself. Fights again. He makes his way to the Palace of the Sun. He actually manages to find the person who has captured all the Winter Friends, defeats them down. He manages to help the Winter Friends escape. They call Mother Winter, and she actually freezes everyone. She helps Steve come back, and there's a whole panel of her kind of reaching her hand out to Steve and just saying, good dog, which again is a moment that gets set up to be played off with later, or if you're reading these in chronological order, plays off the previous plot point. But they have a party. Lil and Steve talk about how they're kind of not really as part of the party, and how they make a great team. And we zoom back to the David Aja art where Clint is unconscious. the boys are like, ah, it's over. And so they go to thank Clint and he's asleep. She puts the blanket over him, wishes him a joyous Kwanzaa. And Lucky wakes up, sees them to the door, and then climbs into the couch with Clint and goes to sleep. And that's the end of the issue. It's super quiet. You could take this issue out and not impact the plot of the story, but it's such a great character moment. It's another look into Clint's mind, how he sees other people, and also just shows the relationship he has with some of the other people in his apartment complex, which is such an important piece of making all of this really gel together. But then we go to issue 8, My Bad Penny. It was written by Matt Fraction, art by Dave Aja, color by Matt Hollingsworth, and letter by Chris Olipiolis. So this is another example of going back to the boss's wife, who is now claims her name is Penny. Through this, hence the name, Penny. One thing I want to note, because I can't really... It's not part of the narrative, throughout the issue, Annie Wu, I had to double-check real quick, actually does a whole bunch of splash pages that are fake romance covers, all done through the lens of what's going on at the moment it's around. So for example, there's one called Doomed Love, which is a picture of Clint, with, various women in his life, including Kate around him in little hearts. And there's, another one, jump ahead real quick to, A Girl Like You, which shows, Penny kind of working as a cocktail waitress at a strip club. And she's crying, saying, with all the other girls around, how am I getting them to notice me? And so there's all these different style of romance comics, and they're all clearly meant to be older romance comics, to kind of like them in the 60s style in a few different places. Also, it's 15 cents on each cover, so harkening back more generally to older romance comics, and also specifically to the fact that Marvel used to do romance comics around the time they started the superhero universe. There actually were several. Millie the Model was a very popular one, and outsold actually Marvel early on, around the time the Fantastic Four started launching. So, like, outsold the Marvel superhero comics at the time, until the super comics became the dominant form of it. So, nice little nod to Marvel's history specifically, but also in general, interesting way to kind of show what's in various characters' heads in a very visual way with a very different art style. But they also all run to the plot, which I'll explain in a second. Because they're also, each of them has a number and a month on them, like all comic covers do. But we start with Penny. She has a gun in her hands. She's pointed at a man with a red safe, and he has a bullet hole. And so she drops the gun and runs. And so we, in one page, immediately see why she was on the run. We saw her way back at picture 3. We cut to her arriving at the Avengers Mansion, and there's a door, there's a kind of an ornate A above the door, and she's kissing Clint. So we jump right from her running away to this, and we kind of fill in. She goes to the Avengers Mansion, she opens the door, and she's kissing Clint on the doorway. There are playing cards flying around. After she kind of explains, I need your help, and he's like, this looks bad, right? Yeah, in my head, this looks bad. And we cut to three other Avengers characters, and they have cards either in their hair or on their head facing outwards. And so basically, I forget the name of the game, but there's a card game where you try to guess each other's card, but you don't know what card you have. You're trying to guess the card you have based on what other people are guessing about other cards. So, it is the Black Widow. Who was Clint's first crush, and he was in love with her back in early 60s Avengers. There is Mockingbird, who actually was married to Clint at one point, and then they got divorced. And then there's Spider-Woman, who Clint was dating, and then it got complicated. And at this stage of Marvel Comics, it's unclear what their relationship is, but they certainly believe they have a relationship. So naturally, Spider-Woman, Jessica Drew, she becomes very angry, defensive. Who the hell is this woman? Why is she dressed like this? Natasha is immediately goes into spy mode of like, she's lying. What's going on? You shot somebody. You need to go to the police. As he kind of stumbles through this encounter and then ultimately shoves her out the door, Mockingbird's like, this is classic Clint. This is exactly the reason why I divorced him. And it's true. This is what Clint does. Clint says someone sent him a whole bunch of comic books in the mail recently. And she's like, yeah, I sent them to you. And he's like, don't read my comics. And she's very adamant about not reading her comics. And it's like, okay, whatever. And so he's like, your real name's not Cherry. And it's like, no. And he goes for he's asking her questions, and she pulls the line. She pulls from issue 3, which is ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies. She kind of seduces him into helping out over at Little Irkutsk, which is kind of the fictional part of Eric, because they're not actually Russian. It is implied they're Russian. They're written in Russian language, but also it's a case of this is a slightly fictionalized country to come from, which is pretty common for Marvel to do. They're going into a strip joint to try to they're knocking over a strip joint to try to get information. So she goes in as an exotic dancer. We realize as they're talking about the plan in the car that Kate is the driver. They're casing this joint in her purple VW bug. And she's like, you know, are you going to stick around? Cause you're kind of the getaway person. And she's like, get arrested. No, go to hell. And so she just drives off. Immediately there's kind of a moment where, they keep talking about, I hope I'm not right. Von Bashpul. Talking about Von Bashpul joint. And so later on, Clint goes, when this article is Von Bashpul up, because the giants don't say strip, they put a Russian word there written in Cyrillic. And so they keep referencing that as kind of a metaphor for tits, basically. And so later on, the name of the club is Bashpul Town. So they keep using this word as a placeholder for the lewder version of the word that we know there. So it's a nice way to kind of sell the seediness of this area without actually breaking the kind of particular comic code that the comic code doesn't exist anymore, but the kind of family friendly ish tone that the comic needs to go for at this point in Marvel history. So Clint beats his way in, starts beating up on the Tracksuit Mafia guys in the chaos. Formerly Cherry, now Penny, slips in her outfit. She finds the red safe that we saw before. The boss in the white suit points a gun at her and threatens to kill her. Clint steps in during the fight or during the altercation, punches him out. She has the safe. The police arrive, point a gun at him. He's like, hey, I'm an Avenger. He's like, are you Iron Fist again? Clint doesn't get respect he believes he deserves. I'm an Avenger. My ID's in the wallet. While Penny slips out the back, we see Clint's actually getting processed through jail, and she's outraged that he read her comics. And was like, he's trying to talk about something else, and she's just mad about the comics. He's like, well, why are you so wound up his comics? It's like they were in a specific order. The order the comics were in, the numbers of the issue numbers, each of them was the actual code to the safe. But because she doesn't have the comics in order anymore, she doesn't have the combination of the safe that they arrive. She's like, whatever. And it's implied just that the safe is some kind of special safe where if you try too many times, the contents will be destroyed. So they can't just guess at the combination. So she's like, whatever. And she takes a robe off and disappears. We cut to, a very shadowy meeting room, and it's explicitly shadowy. Like the background is completely black, and the shadows of the characters from the inking also blends into the black of the background. So the initial panel is just a huge slab of white, and then the white suit of the Kingpin at the end of the table, and we're seeing lots of different characters like Owlman and Hammerhead. And they're only kind of mentioned, but if you know these characters, a lot of these characters are Spider-Man villains or Daredevil villains. This kind of local New York superhuman underorganized crime figures, and they're all talking to the guy in the white suit. the Tracksuit Mafia, and he's like, I'll give you a percentage if you kill Clint Barton. And they bicker and argue. It's like, killing an Avenger is bad for business. And it's like, I'll give you, he's upping it 15%. I'll give you 15% of the take on top of the vig I already give you. And they keep negotiating. And eventually they vote on it, and they vote to agree. It's like, you know, here's Kingpin in particular. It's like, here's the benefits of eventually killing Marshall. And other people are like, no, I'm out. This is too much for me. But they finally agree, and the issue ends with a black circle and a teardrop, and it says, you dead now, bro, you dead now. So they've agreed to hire a killer. And so we end with issue 9, Girls, written by Matt Fraction, art by David Aja, color by Matt Hollingsworth, and letter by Chris Alibiolis. This is kind of the lead up to the beginning of the last issue. So we kind of zoom into the mansion. Penny's walking in with the same dress we saw her wearing last issue. Jarvis is opening it up. We see Clint behind him with a card on his head, her kissing her in the same pose that we had before. So this is kind of a lead up to that. And we see again the cut of the three women. But now we see what happens during issue 8. From the perspective of the three characters. And I love this because each of these sections is prefaced by a little icon of the character's name and the relationship with Clint. So we start with Natasha, the Black Widow. There's a little kind of Black Widow with a heart behind it, and she is the work wife. And so she does some research and finds out that Penny's name is Darlene Penelope Wright. She is trying to, we cut to her going through Grand Central Station, and Natasha tracks her down. They have a chase scene through Grand Central Station, she calls out her real name, how it tracked down. So again, like, Natasha is so skilled, like, she figures girls' stuff out in like 3 panels, whereas Clint has it figured out in several issues, which argument towards Clint's veracity and skill, but also an argument towards the fact that Clint's not really thinking straight, obviously. Puts her on a bus, and it's like, she's worried about how many people Clint Barton has pissed off trying to help out Penny. And it's like, yeah, but we're the Avengers. And it's like, yes, but then if you wanted to kill the Avengers, you make a list. Who do you kill first? You kill the regular guy. And Natasha points out that Clint Barton's the last man I would call a regular guy. Penny is like, you know, I tried to help. I wanted to keep safe, but I've got to go because I know what's going to happen. And so Natasha's like, Clint, what have you been up to? And then we cut to Mockingbird, Bobby, who's the ex-wife. Again, a little heart with a mockingbird on it. Bobby went to Clint's apartment and basically starts to call him out on his shit. Specifically, she has the final divorce papers, which is impressive because they got a divorce, if I remember correctly, sometime in the 80s. We are in 2013, and the first time from the first person, Marvel time is a very weird thing. I do not have time in this podcast to talk about Marvel time. She's calling out kind of what Clint's doing. And at one point he's like, do you have a pen? She's like, yeah, hang on. Let me go. I have one in the car. I'll go back. She goes out to see, the two of the men who are in the van across the street. They're like, hey, we should probably take care of this. She tries to shoot her with an Uzi. She beats the crap out of both of them and tries to figure out, who are you guys? She breaks into she attacks the car, and the car drives into a fire hydrant, which douses her in water. So we cut to her in Clint's robe, which we previously saw Penny wearing, and she's toweling off her hair. He said, you know who these guys are? And he's like, I don't know, Russians maybe. He finally hands papers over. It's like, there you are, you know, we're officially divorced. happy Valentine's Day, because it's February 14th. So as we bounce around the timeline, this is kind of right around the time before he got the 24-hour ultimatum. So again, little note is that not spelled out a ton, but it's like if you start trying to reconcile all the different issues and where things, this is all happening kind of in the same week. I'm wrong. This is 2 months later. My bad. This is February, not December. My bad. Whew. I'm clearly wrong on that. Ignore what I just said. I would normally cut that out, but nah, this is my thoughts as they're live. We talked before, it's kind of a DIY podcast, so I'm kind of just do it out there. Then we cut to Kate, who naturally has a heart with an arrow through it, and her relationship is Kate. So again, ambiguous, unclear. The other three characters actually confront Kate in her bedroom, and it's like, who is that girl? What's going on? What kind of trouble? And she's like, did you just come into my apartment? And they don't care. They just keep asking her questions. And it's like, you know, have you tried, you know, Clint keeps records of this stuff. You can't you just see what wrote down and say, have you tried reading his handwriting? And they're talking about how Avengers have to kind of, they can't be involved in aiding and abetting a criminal. So basically they're like going, so Kate, you have to ask yourself, do you want to be an Avenger? And which ties back to a subplot we saw mentioned in Young Avengers sense, where the Avengers want to see themselves as Avengers, but the Avengers are still considering if they consider them to be Avengers or not. So tying back a little bit to that plot. But she called, Kate gets onto a motorbike and she calls Clint and he gets the answering machine. And this ties back to earlier panel we saw of Clint answering machines and Kate going, who actually has an answering machine in this day and age with actual tape in it? But then Kate goes, beats up some of the tracksuit mafia folks, and she watches Jessica Drew, who is going to the apartments. And so she's like, oh no. She's like, sorry, Clint, stop it. So Jessica, the friend girl, shows again, it's a heart with the separate webs on it. And she basically opens the door and she just slaps his face. And he says, wow. And she slaps him again. And he's like, you want to come in or he's going to beat the hell out of me in the hallway for all the neighbors to see. So she comes in and she calls him out. It's just like many of their characters. But it's like, why you didn't think about my feelings? You know, have you ever thought about the fact of sleeping around? What would hurt me? But it turns out that you just didn't think that much of me. And she goes to slap him again. And he blocks it this time. He's like, I get that you're mad, but you're not allowed to do that anymore. So they pause. Kate steps in. And Jessica Drew says, you're a bad person, Clint Barton. You're so wrapped up in hating yourself that anytime anyone starts to get care about you, or God forbid you start to care about them, you push them away. You get it to me. You get it to Bobby. And then Clint goes, hey, we were married for years. And then she's like, and you bailed the second it got difficult because you're so selfless. And then so she turns to Kate and says, when I was your age, if someone my age told me what to do, I would have laughed at them. But listen to me. Don't hang out with them. He'll only let you down. It's a superpower. So Kate kind of stands, you know, stays with Clint and is like, you know, she's a bitch, you know, whatever. Don't like her. And he's like, no, she's right. You know, I am a screw up. I'm a bad person. Look at all these things I've done. So it's like, whatever, I don't care, do what you want. They are upstairs. We cut to the roof where Grills and Hawkeye are talking. Grills and Clint, I should say, are talking. And he's confessing, and she's like, you should tell her about it. Tell her how you feel. And it's like, I'm going to write her a letter. And then it was a little one like him going, my name's Gil. And it's like, huh, what? Because, you know, he's been getting Clint's name all wrong. And finally, Grills is annoyed that Clint's getting his name wrong. But then he hears his name, Gil. Huh? What? Oh, you got my name right. And we turn, we see a gun. And there's a big panel that says, pff, pff. And we see that Gil has been shot. And we cut to a man with a white trench coat, white face paint, and a black tear under his eye. And it's, I told you I came from hell. Because Gil asked where I came from. So I came from hell. And that is the end of issue 9, kind of our next point where we'll stop. So this is definitely the arc where we see that Clint is spiraling and we see his relationship with his people, his friends and his lovers is very toxic. We see Kate's kind of moving into that space and either as a friend or as a lover. That's still unclear, but still largely coded as friendship. And a lot of the people who historically in the comics have been close to Hawkeye kind of almost turning on him. Even though they still care about him, they still get involved in this problem, but ultimately kind of leave him to deal with it because he pushes them away. And we set up an emotional arc with Gil, and then we see the consequence of that. The people that Clint cares about are starting to die now around him. And this, and the mafia he's pushing in has finally gone so far. They've hired an assassin to take care of it. And so we move to the third part where Clint deals with this threat to his life. So we're now starting to hit the good stuff of the run. But again, I can't stress enough, each issue, there are some issues that are not as great as others, but each one's trying something different, whether it's time change or the comic book romance covers, or playing off kind of a scene happening simultaneously from two different perspectives. There's a lot of artistry and dynamism and happenings, which could have taken a fairly straightforward crime story and is turning it into something interesting and compelling. And again, there's lots of things that are seeds that are being set that will be paid off in later issues, or in previous issues to be out of the reading order. So this is definitely hitting one of the best strides of it. So I hope you've been enjoying listening so far. Next issue will be a shorter run. We're going to do issues 10 through 12 and the annual. So we only have four issues to worry about for next week. But again, now we're getting into the rhythm of things. We're going to slow down a bit more and take more time with each of the issues because this is where we're getting into the good material. So if you have questions or want to chat with me about Hawkeye or really anything else, you can find me on Twitter at Pugstady, PUGSTADY. You can find my website at Pugstady.com, or you can see me hanging out on the Darker Hue Discord. We actually have a comics channel, so I'm happy to talk about Hawkeye or anything else in the comics channel. But with that, I hope you have a good day, and I'll see you next time.